Presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, astronomers say they have discovered an object that appears to be an invisible galaxy made almost entirely of dark matter. The team, led by Cardiff University, claimed it is the first to be detected. A dark galaxy is an area in the universe containing a large amount of mass that rotates like a galaxy but contains no stars. It was found 50 million light years away using radio telescopes. The unknown material that is thought to hold these dark galaxies together is known as dark matter, but scientists still know very little about what that is. And also, the discovery of a frozen sea on Mars, revealed in a new scientist story, has ignited new debate on whether life existed on the red planet. Most intriguing is the claim that the atmosphere above the frozen ocean on Mars may have elevated concentrations of methane. If true, it could suggest that primitive microorganisms might even survive on Mars right now. And that, according to Jean-Peter Miller at the University College London in the United Kingdom, and one of the team that found the frozen sea. In a moment, our guest will be Richard C. Hoagland. We're going to talk to Richard about a few issues, including his brief discussion with Jolene Blaylock from Star Trek Enterprise last night. And then we will bring in British astronomer David Darling with Richard C., and the three of us will sit back, chit-chat, and you, of course, are invited to this campfire discussion with the three of us as we talk about one of Saturn's moons on Coast to Coast AM. Richard C. Hoagland is a former Space Science Museum curator, a former NASA consultant during the the very historic, and I don't even want to say that word anymore, because I believe we went to the moon. He was a science advisor to Walter Cronkite and CBS News, and for years, Richard has been leading an outside scientific team and a critically acclaimed independent analysis of possible intelligently designed artifacts on Mars. And in the past several years, he and his team's investigators have been extended to include more than 30 years of previously hidden data from NASA, Soviet, and Pentagon missions to the moon. A very special night tonight on Coast to Coast, because for the main body of the program, Richard C. Hoagland and our other guest, British astronomer David Darling, will be talking about some of Richard's theories about one of Saturn's moons. But right now, for this first half hour, we're going to talk with Richard about some other issues that are going on, including, Richard C., in my history of hearing you and knowing you, I have never heard you nervous before. When you were talking to Jolene last night,
it was weird.
You were shaking.
I really was. You know, she has such an incredible voice for radio. I mean, if Star Trek does go off the air, she could get a job, you know, in radio. She could become, you know, your alter ego.
How would you like to have been in the studio with her like I was?
I was going to say, that must have been pretty interesting.
I composed myself, Richard C., and
you sounded very calm, very collected.
That's because we pre-recorded all my questions, and I wasn't even in the studio. Well, she's a wonderful person, and I think one of the things and why we are so excited about being live at 10 in Los Angeles specifically is because a lot of people like Jolene are going to make themselves, and they already are, by the way, available to us. And we're not going to do it all the time, but every once in a while they'll pop into the studio and talk a little bit about what they're doing, and I think that's fun. And the fact that we're on at 10 is important because they have friends that just don't like to stay up late like so many of us do, and I think that's going to be great for all of us.
Well, you know, this country has several capitals. Washington, of course, is the political capital, and New York is the financial capital, and Hollywood, L.A., where you are, is the entertainment and information capital.
And by the way, Coast to Coast is now number one in Washington, D.C., in New York, and in Los Angeles.
Excellent, excellent. By the way, I want people to get a pencil and paper ready. I'm going to be giving out some numbers and websites because tonight we're going to kind of mix research and politics and activism. And that's kind of what I really enjoyed talking with Jolene about last night, because I don't know whether even the Star Trek cast members of Enterprise are aware of the venerable political history of space activism that Star Trek has played in this country and in this nation's space program.
Some may, but not a lot, because some of the newer members of Star Trek probably aren't aware of that.
Well, when you look at the opening of the Enterprise series, that opening film with the music and all that, what the producers did is they very elegantly put in some of the history of that involvement that we were directly responsible for in the opening of Enterprise. So I have a very fond spot in my heart for the Enterprise series, and frankly, that's one of the reasons I don't want to see it go down without a fight. If you look carefully, you'll see that it's a kind of a historical reprise of a series of historical ships that over the centuries have been named Enterprise. And there is the Space Shuttle Enterprise, very prominently featured. And then there's previous ships and post ships, and then finally you wind up with the USS Enterprise, the starship that precedes the famous, you know, starship of Captain Kirk. Well, what the audience may not know, and what Jolene may not know, and what a lot of the members who work on the series who are new may not know, is that all of that, in fact, is real archaeological and archival history in the flesh. It was 1976, I believe, in the spring. I was at a meeting in a suburb of Washington, D.C., which was a kind of a space activist group, and we would get together probably once or twice a month. And this particular night, it was kind of a thrill because George Takei was at the meeting. And you remember George Takei is.
Yes.
He played Sulu in the original series.
Yes, and I've seen him walking. Well, let's see. Did I see him?
Yeah, you commented one.
Yes, I did.
Saw him in a mall or something.
Yes.
So, well, George has always been very interested in the real world. And people may or may not know that Gene Roddenberry and I became friends way, way back, many, many years ago, and I became a kind of an informal consultant to the first series, and that, of course, dates me. But be that as it may, George was at this meeting this night, and a friend of mine, who was a policy consultant to the White House, who also was a friend of mine, so he was into the kind of interesting stuff I was into, came kind of swinging by on his way home, and we all sat down, and there were some discussions about, you know, where the space program was going, where NASA was going, and this was back in the mid-70s, so we were just off the peak of the Viking experience, and it was a very heady time. So the conversation turned to what my friend had been talking to some big mucky-muck in the White House about, and they'd been talking about the space shuttle, which, of course, then was a twinkle in NASA's eye, because we didn't have a shuttle. And my friend said, you know, well, I kind of said as a joke, you know, why don't we call the damn thing the Free Enterprise? And we all looked at each other, and I said, would you mind saying that again? And the upshot was that we decided to mount a national campaign with the help of a few people, including Carol Rosen, who, as you know, was a consultant to Wernher von Braun in those years.
Okay, right.
And with the use of some phones at a corporation that he and she worked for, they would let me drive out, and we had free phones back in the days when free phones all over the country was really useful. And we organized with the help of a gal named B. Jo Trimble, who was a very important member of the Star Trek fan community back in those days. a campaign coast to coast, from sea to shining sea, and according to the Washington Post, in July of 76, just around the time of the landing of a Viking, we were able to dump 400,000 letters on the White House and NASA from Star Trek fans all over the country, asking them very nicely to please change NASA's plans to call the first space shuttle Constitution and name it Enterprise instead.
How about that?
And then in September, I went to California to, of course, cover the Viking landings, and I was there with Carl when those first pictures came in, Carl Sagan, when the first pictures came in from Viking in that pre-dawn where it looked like it was Arizona or New Mexico with the blue sky and the sandy deserts and all that. And I had this incredible Viking summer, which was another whole couple of shows. So in September, right around the time of the second landing of the second spacecraft, I was awakened at like 5 or 6 in the morning by my friend from the White House. And he said, "Dick, the president did it." I said, "What?" He says, "Yes, the president has overruled NASA, and they're going to call her Enterprise." And he gave me the story. It seems that James Fletcher, who was then the administrator of NASA, came into President Gerald Ford's office that morning, because it was 3 hours later back east, and he had a little model of the space shuttle with him. And he was, you know, sitting in the Oval Office, and, you know, he stood up and he came toward the president and he said, "Mr. President, we want you to come to the christening and the rollout, and we're going to, you know, call her Constitution." And according to my friend, eyewitness, he said the president came around his desk, put his hand on Fletcher's shoulder, and says, "No, Jim, we're going to call her Enterprise."
I love it.
Don't you love it?
That's a great story.
Well, what it shows is why this series, this idea, this dream of my dear friend Gene Roddenberry is so critical. Because what we mounted in that campaign was the first effort of the space constituency to basically demand something of its space program. And without belaboring the point, you know, we might do it later on through the evening when David joins us, NASA's reaction back then was as churlish and as mean-spirited and as bizarre over something as simple as people simply wanting to name their shuttle what they wanted as any of the reactions that we have reported on this program over the ensuing years.
So they even fought that?
Oh, they fought it tooth and nail. They sent representatives to Star Trek conventions. Remember how Jolene said she's never been to a Star Trek convention?
She's got one coming up in March, her first one.
She has incredible experience coming up. Because there's where you meet real people who have one foot on the ground, you know, in normal, real lives, and another foot somewhere out there where they know the human species has to go if it is going to survive. So I was so thrilled to hear last night basically say with Hawking that unless we get off this planet in a big way, we're not going to make it, because that's exactly what I feel and why I put so much effort into what we've been doing all these years.
Well, and talking about efforts, I can't wait for David to join us as we look at some of the work you've done on that website over the past week or so since we last talked. And you know what? Because since you gave me a warning that even I couldn't get into your website later, I downloaded and printed all three parts. And I got to tell you, I was afraid my printer was going to burn up, because those are a lot of pages, Richard.
Well, it's a lot of data, and we try to document. This is, you know, we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves, but this is a scientific hypothesis. I admit immediately that it's absolutely off the wall. It's outrageous. It's extreme by any measure. But the difference between that and non-science is this is testable. We can find out. And that's why I want people to have their pencils and papers ready, because as we get later into the evening, I'm going to give you some websites and phone numbers where your response, your vote, like our original Star Trek campaign to the President of the United States, where he overruled NASA and said, "Jim, we're going to call her Enterprise." I mean, there's an historical fact. And a lot of science journalists, you know, reported on this. My friend at Science News, which is that really spiffy little weekly news magazine.
I get that, yeah.
Still being published. Well, my friend John Eberhardt probably wrote the best editorial on what this all meant, because, you know, he said that, you know, what we wanted to call it was kind of irrelevant. The fact that a bunch of space activists, space enthusiasts, people who had this vision, asked something of their government for the first time in the space arena and got it was the most important mark of that campaign. And I totally agree with him, because unless you stand up and are a squeaky wheel, you'll get run over. We have got to demand several things of the space effort. First and foremost is honesty. And that's the thing that I'm sure we're going to have some interesting conversations with David Darling tonight about, because, frankly, the space program has not been honest and forthcoming, not just with Americans, but with people over this planet. And that's why this TV show, just a TV show, but it began in Gene's mind as a way to show the world what a real space program at the time when we were post-moon landing, right? Remember, that was back in the late 60s after we had, you know, been, and people's interest was winding down, and NASA was cutting the money and canceling missions and all that. Gene wanted something that would extend this idea of what a real human presence in space could mean and how it would wield people into a unified human species here on Earth. And he did things in that series that were incredibly cutting edge for the time. The first black on the bridge of a starship, the first woman in command,
yes.
Things like this.
Yes, he very smartly did that, too.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, you know, we had all kinds of stories over drinks behind the scenes as to the fights he had with the network. And then, of course, the big thing was that as he launched this experimental program, the network was going to basically cut it out from under him and cancel it. They actually said, just like they've said now, different network, you know, well, Star Trek is not pulling any numbers, we're not getting any ratings, nobody gives a damn, you know, we're canceling. And that's why, prior to the Enterprise campaign, prior to the success of getting the president to overrule NASA, we went into battle the first time, and we were able, with the help of a few of our friends and the fans and the fan clubs, to turn the network around.
Well, let me tell you something, just from experience. I know when I first came in here and took over this program from the master, Art Bell, there were some program directors who just weren't sure of me. You know, I came out of St. Louis, and I was doing the backup for Art, but they just weren't sure. So in some cases, some of them had already made decisions to bring in some different shows. And let me tell you something. We have recaptured in such a large fashion now those old affiliates. Not only are we back on, but our ratings are higher than ever. And all of it was done because of our Coast listeners who contacted those respective stations, big stations and top markets, and said, we want Coast to Coast back. These program directors, Richard, began to look at this and say, you know what? They're right.
Well, the KFI experience is absolutely, speaking truth to power. I mean, it demonstrates what we all knew had to happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I congratulate the program director, Robin Bertolucci, who called me up when she made this decision, and she said, I'm going to tell you something. So many Coast to Coast listeners have been writing into us, have been emailing us, have been calling us, and she said, you know, I know you're number one from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m., and I know you were number one when you were on at 10 p.m., but I'm going to tell you, this is the right thing to do, and they're very excited about this. But again, Richard, and what you're telling me is absolutely correct. It is the strength of the listeners or the viewers, in Star Trek's case, that can make this happen.
It's democracy in action, George, and for something important, which is ideas. There is so little on television these days that talks about ideas. And Star Trek, Gene's vision was always it would be a platform for ideas, and there are all kinds of ideas to explore, as we will, you know, demonstrate as we go through the evening, but they're not being explored by our space agency. They're being explored in television by a few brave producers and writers and directors and actors who are willing to boldly go where no one has gone before.
Now, David Darling, who will be with us in just a few minutes, very excited about being on the program with you, Richard. He has his website called the basically daviddarling.info. He tackles everything from silicon-based life to UFOs. He's right in your arena as well, so it's going to be fascinating to hear the two of you chit-chatting a little bit. And I'll, in some cases, just simply sit back and drink my ice water while you two chat.
It should be an easy night for you.
Hey, when you're on, it's always an easy night.
Aw, thanks.
Now, you stick around. Your website, by the way, enterprisemission.com. How's the server doing? You got it beefed up?
It looks like it's going to hold up. We have a brand new Mars story that we're probably going to talk about first, which we probably should after the break. There's been, as you read in your little news item, some major breaking new news regarding this frozen ocean they found, and a new paper delivered this afternoon by Formosano, which connects up with that. So as we come back after the bottom of the hour, we'll talk about that first, and then we'll swing all the way out to Saturn and a moon with a view.
Absolutely. We'll get David Darling on the line as we go live to England. We'll bring him in on the discussion as well. So sit back, relax, enjoy yourself. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment with this special edition of Coast to Coast AM, the historic discussion between Richard C. Hoagland and British astronomer David Darling.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely nights dreaming of a song, the melody haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you. When our love was new, and each kiss an inspiration, but that was long ago, and now my consolation is in the stardust of a song.
From somewhere out there, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And in a moment, British astronomer David Darling along with Richard C. Hoagland. Hey, we only have a few more days left and we can no longer make the free CD of Mel's Hole available to you when you order the After Dark newsletter, so take advantage of it. You can call 1-888-727-5505. You can also go online to order the After Dark newsletter, which is a great magazine, full color, www.coasttocoastam.com. In a moment, Richard C. Hoagland, David Darling. David Darling is a British astronomer with a PhD from the University of Manchester, England. He's the author of more than 40 books on subjects ranging from life in the universe to life after death, from cosmology to consciousness. His latest book is the Universal Book of Astronomy, 600-pager A to Z of Astronomy, his website. Also, The Worlds of David Darling tackles everything from silicon-based life to UFOs. DavidDarling.info is his website. Hi, David. How are you?
I'm just fine, George. How are you doing?
Welcome back, and say hello to Richard C. Hoagland, David. He's on the other line.
Hi, Richard. How are you doing?
Hi, David. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Pleasure, too, yeah.
Hey, David, the big story breaking here, and Richard has got some input, too, and we want to get your reaction to the discovery of a frozen sea on Mars. Richard, why don't you set the stage for this story for us?
Well, about 4 years ago, Mike Barra and I, one of my colleagues, wrote a very comprehensive paper called A Mars Tidal Model, and we published it on the Enterprise website. We sent copies to various, you know, people in the planetary field. We tried to actually, you know, deliver an abbreviated version at the Lunar and Science Conference held annually in Houston, and we were unfortunately turned down in 2001. But it's received a wide, review, and it made certain specific predictions related to the discoveries of water and ice and the locales on Mars where these would be found. And this latest discovery from the Mars Express team, John Murray of the Open University, is stunningly accurate in terms of confirming exactly what we said 4 years ago, both in terms of latitude, longitude, and the amount of water, frozen water, ice that would probably be discovered at some point by future missions. And if you go to enterprisemission.com, the first story tonight in a new box under the God Man and E.T. banner at the top is an article called The Ice Storm, edited, written by Mike Barra. And if you click on that, if you can get in, you'll see a couple, three pages with graphics delineating this new discovery of John Murray and his team related to our paper of 4 years ago. And the most important thing, George, is when you click on it. Are you there? Have you saved it?
I am looking at what I have printed up.
Okay.
I'm not going to the website. I can't.
Okay. Well, then at the top you'll see there's this double picture of the ice flows on Mars,
mm-hmm,
and ice flows in Antarctica. And then under that there is a graph. And this graph is from our paper of 4 years ago, and you'll see a little white dot above the line marking the equator.
Right.
And you'll see that's almost at the peak of those two red curves, which is the locale of our two tidal oceans that we posited. And this ice flow situation, this discovery, is located exactly where one of the tidal oceans has to be at the equator.
And, you know, one of the most intriguing is the claim that the atmosphere above the frozen ocean on Mars may have elevated concentrations of methane. David, does that surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me, really, because I've long expected that there's going to be subterranean life on Mars, at least of a simple variety. And the most likely form would be methogenic bacteria. So it doesn't surprise me that we're finding local regions of methane. I should also point out that, you know, if Richard's theory was predicting this ocean, then people should take it seriously. That's the sign of a good hypothesis, isn't it?
Well, there are a number of predictions, David, that have been confirmed, about six of them in total, I believe, up to now.
Mm.
And you can go back and read the paper if you haven't. It's in PDF form as well in HTML. It's been an Enterprise since 2001.
Mm-hmm.
It's been given to Bob Zubrin. We submitted it to the, his annual Mars conferences. We submitted it to the Lunar and Planetary Conference in Houston. We've sent it around. People like Leonard David at space.com got a copy when it was, mm-hmm, fresh off the press many years ago. I'm sure you know him.
Mm-hmm.
So we're well on record of making these specific predictions. And the cool part, you know, is that you can't have science without predictions.
Exactly.
This is a step-by-step, very, yeah, metonymic, very by-the-numbers set, mm-hmm, of predictions as to where, you know, you will find more. I mean,
yeah,
we actually say in the piece, if John Murray and his team want to find additional evidence, all they have to do is go and look at our curves.
Exactly. And I think people, you know, in looking at what you said, should not necessarily look at all the theories you put forward. You know, this is a specific issue.
So we're already getting into dicey territory. Huh?
Well, I'm saying that they should focus on this one, you know, prediction you've made. Treat that in isolation, and that's a sign of a good scientific hypothesis. It's borne out in reality.
Did you know Carl when he was alive, Carl Sagan?
No, I never knew him personally.
Oh, that's a shame, because from what I've read of your material, you and he would have really clicked, because Carl was known for having a prolific imagination. Mm-hmm. Carl and I had conversations over the years, and you know, we talked about his reputation as a kind of an avant-garde science popularizer.
That's what you need.
And he saw himself as pushing the envelope.
Yeah.
And he said to me, Dick, he says, you don't have to be right every time. You just have to be right when you're right.
Yeah, exactly.
And
exactly.
There is a very chilling effect in the planetary community specifically, but more generally in the science community, that you dare not advance a hypothesis that sounds on the surface silly for fear that you might be wrong.
That is the main problem in Orthodox science. People don't want to stick their head above the parapet. And, you know, Einstein said imagination is more important than knowledge. That's the beginning of knowledge, if you like.
And he also said all science begins in wonder. And when I look at some of the data we're going to talk about tonight, my first reaction as a human being is I am in wonder at what we've got to play with.
Of course.
And I'm just so unhappy that the guys who are sitting on this data are not willing to be more adventurous. No one's going to hang them. No one's going to string them up by their delicate anatomical parts.
Mm.
You know, either we're right or we're wrong based on the evidence and new evidence. So why don't we have some fun with this?
Well, and we're in a fortunate position, you and I. We're both independent researchers. I'm a writer. We don't have, as it were, a orthodox reputation to uphold, so we can be more adventurous. So perhaps we have that luxury that others don't, but we can talk about that later.
But we had wanted tonight, and George, we're not telling tales out of school here, we had wanted to invite a very centrist, mainstream planetary guy to be part of this conversation.
Yeah.
And he refused.
It's a pity.
The reason he gave, obviously, was very specious. And I pointed out to, one of your producers, George, this afternoon, that the bottom line is that the institution that he works for is funded totally by NASA. And he dare not come on the air and even consider seriously some of the things we're going to talk about because politically they won't like it.
Well, and it could jeopardize his career.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's what we ran into back in 76 when for simply getting people to want to name their shuttle what they saw as a vision of the future of the space program, NASA sent out officially a representative. His name was Jesko von Puttkamer. He was the head. We won't go any further with that one. But he was the head of special and future projects, and he took it upon himself to go to these conventions representing NASA and telling these fans, you have no right to ask NASA to change the name. It's already been decided. Simply, you know, like it.
David, do you know Vittorio Formisano, the Italian scientist, by any chance?
I know of his work. Yeah.
A couple months ago, Richard, when was it, he started talking about methane and formaldehyde,
well,
and then all of a sudden he went away.
He started talking in the spring of 2004 to Linda Moulton Howe. She got a really cool on-the-record interview where she pinned him down, and he basically said by September he hoped to be able to announce formaldehyde, ammonia, and methane from the PFS results from Mars Express. Then September rolled around, and there was this big conference in Ischia. Remember that we had Paula Harris following him all around the island, and he basically wimped out. You know, I'm kind of using colloquial terms here, David, so please, you know, pardon me. It now looks like he has rediscovered his courage, and he stood up at this Mars Express conference apparently this afternoon in Europe, in Belgium, I believe, and he basically said that his results, his spectrometer results of methane concentrations as given to him over the last couple of years from the spacecraft results and the summing of the various orbits, because if you take an observation on one orbit, it has a certain amount of error, but if you sum 100 orbits, you drive the noise down and the signal up. So you can see faint signals that way. He said basically that his methane peaks over the exact locale of the new frozen ocean discovered on the photographs from Express and, of course, peaks on the graph that we have on the website showing the ocean we predicted 4 years ago.
Now, David, do you have any doubts at all that based on the fact that they're getting readings of methane really high in a specific area, that there's some biological organisms there.
Oh, yeah, I have doubts.
And oh, you do? Okay.
I think you should have doubts, because there are other explanations. There are geological explanations as well. I personally favor the biological, and I think, you know, that's the way things are moving. But you should have doubts about it. You know, we need to look more closely. We need to look at the isotopic concentrations. We need more data. But it's definitely leaning that way. There's no question about it.
Do you support sending a man or men to Mars?
When we're ready for it, I do. I think we should, you know, make sure that we have the infrastructure in place to support a huge effort like that. But in the long run, it may be the only way we're going to settle these questions. So, yes, I do, but I want to be cautious. I think, first of all, we need to sort out some problems on our own planet and make sure we don't start, you know, taking those problems elsewhere. But, and as soon as we have the support structure in place, I think we should go for it, yeah.
If we find out that indeed there is life at Mars, as small as organisms, what does that mean to all of us on this planet, David?
It depends where the life's come from. With Mars and Earth being so close together, there is always that possibility of cross-contamination or cross-fertilization, that life may originate in one place and then being, you know, spread to the other by meteorites. So it could be just one instance of life that just happens to have taken root in two places. If it's a separate instance of life, then it's hugely important. Of course, it's exciting and important anyway, but if it's a second instance of life, that's huge, because then it opens up the possibility of life being very common throughout the universe.
Which, of course, I believe in, Richard, that's been your theory since the beginning.
Well, our paper, the tidal model, which is exactly as the title implies, it basically proposes that Mars was not always alone as a planet orbiting the solar system, but it proceeds from Tom Ben Flandern's work, and David, you obviously know who Tom is, that Mars once was a satellite of a much larger object which no longer is with us, having disappeared through an explosion. And if that was true, our reasoning was there should have been signatures from that satellite era for Mars that would have been left on the planet, and that's what we found, and that's what we base these predictions on. Well, the predictions come with other predictions, because in that model, the life that we're seeing would not be the beginning of the road that never made it farther than microorganisms. It may be a small isolated biosphere that has been reduced drastically in size from a former much larger ecological epoch for Mars, and that, of course, would not be available to us unless we have sufficient spacecraft and or, you know, manned expeditions to actually ascertain what is there and what is not there. But there are many, many implications that are fascinating that will take us into realms that most people don't want to talk about, having to do with, you know, if this is life, is it the beginning or the end?
Well, let me tell you, these are exciting times for space, and David, for you as an astronomer, have you ever been at a time where looking into the heavens could be any more exciting?
I guess the only time I can remember being this excited is when, you know, the first Apollos were going up, and you know, we had this, you know, beginning of the human migration into space. But there's so much going on now, and there's so much promise, particularly in the field of astrobiology and SETI. That it seems to be just accelerating now. We seem to be getting more and more evidence of extraordinary things going on out there.
What's your views of the death of the impending death of the telescope Hubble?
Well, it's a tragedy, because it's a fine instrument, and you just wonder how these things happen. Really, it's one of the prime astronomical instruments, and now we're just going to allow it to, you know, burn up in the atmosphere. It just seems extraordinary that we could get ourselves into that position. And we're spending so many billions on this International Space Station, which is producing very little scientific return, you know, for the investment.
What's so ironic, too, both you, David, and Richard, are astronauts who, of course, risk their safety whenever they have to go up there and fix the Hubble. They want to continue doing that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the sort of thing we should be doing in orbit, you know, not just having two guys sitting around in this vast empty structure, just keeping the thing patched up and hoping that, you know, we're not going to get a hole blown in the side or the oxygen isn't going to fail. You know, we really ought to be maintaining these prime scientific instruments, which are just telling us about the universe. So it's just an extraordinary, fiasco, really.
I mean, David, you're on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, so you're not privy or part and parcel of the American political system.
Just a few months ago we moved over here. Yeah, that's right.
Oh, that's right. You used to be here.
Yeah, just until October we moved back. We're in Scotland now, but we were in Minnesota for a number of years, yeah.
But, I mean, do you have U.S. citizenship or are you U.K.?
I'm a U.K. citizen. My wife's American. Both our kids are dual citizens, but I'm U.K.
Well, I've been saying on this program and in other arenas for many years that our fundamental problems are not science, they're political.
Mm.
And we see this in this bizarre reaction of the White House and NASA to almost going out of their way to kill this incredibly successful spacecraft that has become almost a person. I mean, it's almost become an icon, as well known as, Jolene last night. More Americans know Hubble as an instrument of discovery and wonder and the frontier than probably know about any other NASA mission, barring maybe the Apollo program.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you have an administrator who, because of his personal trepidation of putting astronauts in harm's way, said, not on my watch. Well, he's gone. But you have a White House this year that isn't planning even to follow through with the minimum, which was the robotic potential rescue mission mandated by both the Senate committee, Barbara Mikulski's committee, mm-hmm. and the National Science Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
It makes no sense other than there is a political effort to get rid of this spacecraft, because the polls say that people, the average American citizen who's paying for these missions, they definitely want Hubble to be saved.
Of course they do. And you know, for the amount that it would cost to maintain it and repair it, you compare that with the billions and billions that is being thrown away uselessly.
And there's nothing to replace it. There are some people who say, oh, we'll have the James Webb telescope, you know, in a couple of years after.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-uh. The James Webb telescope, named after the legendary first administrator of NASA under Kennedy, who actually oversaw the Apollo vision, a really mm-hmm. gutsy guy,
mm-hmm.
Will be looking in the infrared, David. It will not have the visible or the ultraviolet capabilities of Hubble, and there will be a huge gaping hole in the great observatories above the atmosphere to continue this stunning, cutting-edge work.
I know. It makes no sense. It doesn't make any sense at all.
Unless there's an agenda. I come back, gentlemen, to my point, which is when you're dealing with NASA, which when I worked for Cronkite back in those days, you know, we used to say NASA, never a straight answer, NASA. There seems to be some other reason why there's a deliberate effort now to let this thing just die.
I don't know about that, but Richard, when we come back, and you, David, as well, let's go out to Saturn, take a look at one of Saturn's moons, and it's not going to be Titan, and we'll get both the views of an astronomer, and we'll get the views of a researcher, Richard C. Hoagland, David Darling, in just a moment. I'm George Norrie. Take a look at their websites, daviddarling.info and enterprisemission.com. Both of those linked up with coasttocoastam.com if you're already on that website. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.
This part of the show, listen online with Streamlink. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.